is Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1. Let us have a reading of two verses, Sister Carol and then Sister Catherine.
But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned?
All right. So you notice that in the book of Nehemiah, not only does it the lineage take, you know, a few chapters and so forth, but this running conflict between Sanballat and Tobiah, among others, has continued for some time. Now we're on chapter 4. And this is like sarcasm, and but with the intent to weaken the focus of the returned Jews, to diminish their attention in the repairing of the walls as being like an almost impossible task. And in course, in this rebuilding work, we can be assured that the Lord chose Nehemiah, probably the most fit man possible, for this particular type of a project, and that the problems that he would encounter and how to resolve them. And we begin to see certain things about him that reflected into Nehemiah's character, how he was not led astray. All right, now here we see this sarcasm. But what this does tell us is that the utter state of ruin that must have existed, that they themselves probably felt that this is an impossible task. Do you think that out of this rubble you're going to really prosper and build this wall and all? I mean, this is, you're dreaming. But the fact that eventually they finished the building of this wall in how many days?
52
days. So that indicates that's miraculous, considering the immensity of the task, and that this building of the walls is not predicated on the number of people that returned to Israel, but was the rebuilding of the old walls of a relatively large city, of which the returned remnant, which was like 42,000 people out of 2 million, you know, that, I mean, this is quite a change. Quite a challenge. All right, now, notice, will they fortify themselves? And will they sacrifice? Will they revive the stones and so forth? Any comment now? Verses 1 and 2.
Brother, what was the cause for the tenacity of that Sanballat and Tobiah?
Well, this is mixed company. These people were placed in the land, we mentioned much earlier, by a Syrian general, but there was intermarriage, we find later, between Jews and these aliens that existed on the outskirts of Jerusalem and in northern Israel. But we only learn this as we go along, that in spite of what Ezra did, remember when we read the book of Ezra, separate yourselves and all, and there were And they obeyed, and the wives were put away, and the children, and so forth. Some accommodations were made. But we would surmise that they were not put 1,000 miles away, but they went into the outer environs and settled there. And, of course, if they're now without husbands, they would marry. And you have Jewish and Samaritan blood. This is the Samaritans, like a half-breed race with mixed ideas of religion, but they seem to like the thought of one God. That the return Jewry never effected from that. Before that, they had all kinds of gods before the Babylonian captivity. Well, it seems that even the Samaritans adopted the idea of one God. And what's also interesting, that they're not the only ones. We have, like today, the Mohammedans, who believe in one God, which is, but they have mixed ideas, and they think it's through Ishmael instead of through Isaac and so forth. But it's this similarity. And I think Sanballat had his eye on the priesthood. As I recall, there's some intermarriage, and he could claim priestly background through this intermarriage relationship, and that he may have had his eye on being high priest. This is just my own imagination, because I'm not that too deep a scholar to take time to go into that. But he had motives in mind. And remember, they wanted to originally help build the city with the others. So I think he had aspirations along that line, like other people have aspirations for political power in the civil governing aspect. But when he was rebuffed time and again by Nehemiah, you know, he then resorted to all kinds of strategy. I don't think we've come to that yet. To try to inveigle his way in, and then he's now mad, because I think we read in the first verse or so, he was like filled with indignation. So he, this is the result of all the strategies that he had involved before, came to naught, did not frustrate Nehemiah's purpose. And now he tried through sarcasm and so forth to dishearten the people who were returned, who had returned from Babylonian captivity, the Jewry, from listening to Nehemiah, to his commands.
Friend, yeah. Hadn't he and some others wanted to participate in this reconstruction, and they were rejected in the past?
Yes, we had referred to that a little earlier. All right, can we continue? Verses 3 through 5 in this case.
Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, "Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity, and cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders."
All right. Notice the first verse you read was what about Tobiah being accompanying Sanballat and being in full sympathy with what was going on, but that the next two verses is what Nehemiah's feelings and response are. Now this is about the fox, and he comments about that if they build a wall, if a fox go up, he shall break down.
Like the height of sarcasm, yeah.
Yeah. That there'd be, we use the term, when we use it in a legal sense, we call it loopholes. in the tax laws or some little that no matter how you try to do something to keep the rich from getting richer and evading taxes and so forth, there are loopholes in the law. Well, they're saying that with all their efforts to build this wall of fortification, why, the foxes can get in there. That's it. There's so many cracks and so many loopholes. We also know that in this building, that when they built the walls and they were developing, that the gates were done really last. So you would have the wall being built and the preparations made for the doors, like the, we had read, I think, something about beams and things like that, but the doors themselves were not set on the hinges so that it was closed. So you have this wall being in process of being builded with the gates openings still there. And so they're saying, well, with all this impression, you know, building a wall, and here are all these openings. But Nehemiah had a reason for that, and he had a strategy how to meet it, which we'll try to see if we come upon the convenient verses to edify us more along that line. That's about the fox was in verse 3. Now, verse 4 is Nehemiah's comment, reaction, and prayer. And he beseeches the Lord to not only counteract what they were trying to do, but that he was praying for retribution upon Sanballat and Tobiah and his followers. And notice verse 5, you can see Nehemiah was kind of stirred up. Cover not their iniquity, let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. So they not only were they reproaching Nehemiah, in this effort to build the wall of the city, but it was a reflection on the God, their God, and that this was done in open, in an open fashion. This it reminds you a little bit of another situation where the Israel was bottled up in the city, and somebody else.
Sennacherib.
All right, that's right, Sennacherib. But his. Like his general, one of his generals. I'm trying to think of his
name. Rabshakeh, was it?
Yeah, that's right, Rabshakeh. That he was taunting. And he did this in the presence, not merely of Isaiah the prophet and the king. Hezekiah was King Hezekiah. But he did it in the presence of Jewry and... he was even advised, don't speak in the Hebrew, speak, you know, but he wanted the populace to hear. And this is the effect here. They're trying to do the same thing. And give them for a prey in the land of captivity. Cover not their iniquity. All right, let's read now two verses. Next, please.
So built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah, and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up, and that the breaches began to be stopped, they were very wroth.
All right. We would say that in that last verse, the word they should be emphasized. See, because first, the original contention was Sanballat and Tobiah. But he got others to join the chorus of opposition. Sanballat and Tobiah got others to raise the outcry. And so that when we read... verse 7 at the end, began to be stopped, then they were very wrought. That is the others, because Sanballat and Tobiah were already incensed. So they got others. And now a conspiracy would be plotted. Now it says to the half thereof. What's the half? The wall was sort of, was adjoined to the half.
To half its height, it says in Revised.
That's right. That's right. Not half in circuit, but half. It was built to half its height. And now we can see, too, another reason that the doors of the walls and all would not be put into place until it was sufficiently high. Because the tower, there were towers over the gate, so the wall would have to be built, the second half would have to be completed before the doors of the gates really could be inserted. But now they're working with great intensity, and they're working, as it were, as long as there was daylight, as it were. Next, the what verse?
Verse 8.
Verse 8, all right. Let us read 8 through 10.
This is the Revised. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. But Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, and there is much rubbish. We are not able to work on the wall.
Yeah. All right. There you can see, it's one thing to build from scratch, right? Mm-hmm. Than to have something in the way, and especially stone material, rubbish, to clear that all out of the way to build the wall. Well, that would be very disheartening work, and especially if you worked a full, let us say, 12-hour day in one capacity or another, the fatigue that would set in. When you finish the book and you look back on Nehemiah, the different things he did, you wonder who in the world could have ever done what he did. Ezra couldn't do that, because Ezra was along moral lines. I think he was maybe superior to Nehemiah, Ezra, in character. But Nehemiah, in judgment, in with more savvy and training from when he was in Persia. And there were a lot of things about Nehemiah. Maybe they'll come into this mix later on as we continue into the book. Now that was, what, 8, verse 8 on. Now this looks like it's going to be a war. And you'll notice, what was it, Ashdod? That's down, that's on the Mediterranean coast. This is on the southwest. So now they're mustering together with the intent, if they're not going to listen to our advice, like Sanballat and Tobiah, well, let's put an end to this thing. But it says that Nehemiah, they continued in prayer, very earnest prayer, and it says, and Judah said, and that would involve quite a number of the Jews who came back. Because remember, when they came back, it was primarily those of Judah and Benjamin. So when it says, and Judah said to Nehemiah, we're getting very fatigued. You know, they wanted to stop the work. But you see, it's this little extra 52 days. Was very crucial. This 52 days of finishing the wall is a short period of time. It's a really short period of time. But this is what means the victory, not only with regard to the little flock, not only with regard to sports and races. It's this last bit of expended energy that makes the difference between victory and defeat. Now you can see they're fatigued, and with the immensity of this project, and you need, like Nehemiah, which he acted something like Moses in a way, although there's no real comparison. Moses is much superior in other ways. We read through
10.
Well, there's a break here, but we'll go through that. Let's read two more verses. Thank you.
And our adversary said, they shall not know, neither see, till we come in amidst them, and slay them, and cause the work to cease. And it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us, ten times, from all places whence shall return, all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon you.
The problem here in reading is we're breaking through the conclusion of one thought and the introduction of another. One verse is a conclusion of something, and another verse, which it's hard to mentally make an adjustment unless we pause. But let's now consider the 11th verse. Now, the strategy of the foes of Nehemiah, for convenience sake, I'm stating it this way, the foes of Nehemiah, they realized that it wouldn't be too easy, because the Israel is now in the city. They're leaving their Ashdod, or wherever they come from. They're leaving their places to attack Jerusalem, but in Jerusalem they're all gathered together. So now the strategy is to infiltrate. To go into the walls. See, the gates are open. And this reminds me of the difference of warfare today. In all the other wars, of Europe, the Prussians and the French and the Gauls and so, you could tell who the enemy was. For instance, the Goths, by their clothing and their armor and the horses, from the Romans, you could tell the difference. And all down through history, they had uniforms, so they had particular type of implements of warfare they carried, so you could tell the enemy. But what has happened since Vietnam, you didn't know the difference between the enemy in North Vietnam and South Vietnam. They look exactly alike. They didn't have uniforms of one particular kind. And the same with North Korea and South Korea. They're Koreans. One's in the north, one's in the south. So their idea was, we'll infiltrate and be people just like they are, and probably in appearance, even their facial their physiognomy was so similar that it would be easy to do this, normally speaking.
That why he talked about the fox?
Yeah, well, maybe they had that in mind. That's a good observation, that if the foxes, natural foxes, that may have been the part of the strategy to infiltrate. And then to treacherously kill when they're off guard. For instance, if you're putting bricks in the wall, even if you have a sword by you, for that moment, you turn your back, they could then, use to slay them. All right. Now, verse 12 states, it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon you. The Now, it mentioned the various places in an earlier verse. Where was that now? The Arabians, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, that they're coming from different places. And they would, their purpose was to infiltrate through the gates. Not the wall, because the wall is half built. The wall, there's the ramp, but the breaches. So they're planning, and they're coming from all sides. And what happens, Nehemiah gets wind of this. He realizes what's we say, using slang, cooking, as it were, what's in the works. And now he is devising a strategy for protection. From all places went they shall return to us, and they will be upon you. Or see, all those words are supplied at the end of the verse. But that's the thought. Let us read 13 and 14, please.
Therefore said I, in the lower places behind the wall, and on the higher places, I even set the people after their families, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked, and rose up, and said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, Be not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses.
All right. So Nehemiah, now, what he's in effect doing, he's dividing the people into like two component parts. One was the work crew, the crew, masons, to do the repairs, to continue the fortification. But the others would be on guard duty, both at the top of the wall, even while they're building it, so that they can see a distance so that there cannot be any surprise entry, and then some at the base, because when you're on top of the wall, how are you going to stop people going through the gate? I mean, here are these openings, and they're on top. They can't just jump down and run around. So he sets them as sentinels, and probably even children, wives. I mean, he used everything. And so those that were not actively employed, they were armed as best they could, depending on capability, as watches. And then he had some at the base of the wall, and they would be secreted. So that when they would see at the top somebody coming, they're coming through the gate so-and-so, then the ones behind the wall would wait. And then if they tried to make a breach through by surprise attack on each side of the portal, would finish them off. At least now they could not infiltrate. So that stopped that strategy. And he now reminds them of the great things that God did in Egypt, the Exodus of Egypt. How the Lord, who was great, defeated the Pharaoh and his host. He's not saying this. This is what's implied. Remember the history of Jehovah, our God. What he has done in the past. The great things he has done in the past. And don't let this scare you or unnerve you. This hostile environment that is around us. Let us read two more verses, please.
And it came to pass, when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work. And it came to pass from that time forth, that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both spears, the shield and the bows, and the haberdine, and the rulers were behind all the houses of Judah.
All right. Now, the enemies would see that their plan was discovered by the very fact seeing them as sentinels on the wall, where before they were not that way. If all of a sudden you have the walls halfway built, nobody on top, in a guard and as sentinels, and then all of a sudden he sets up there these people. Well, they know our plan. So the strategy of infiltration fell flat. Now, how he got the information, it just doesn't tell. Because the Bible is low-key. It's just telling us basically just enough detail so that we can see what the situation is.
Brother Frank, we also could tell them they had weapons, too.
Yeah.
They had spears and shields and bows.
Yeah.
I don't know what their other word is.
Well, that's breastplates. They're like a coat of armor, like for protection. Abergeons, you mean. Let's go another two verses.
They which build it on the wall, and they that bear burdens, with those that laid it, every one with one of his hands wrought in the work, with the other hand held it, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword girded by his side, and so built it. And he that sounded the trumpet was by me.
All right. Now, he had another, he gave advice to the people in this defensive attitude. The Jews, Nehemiah, told them that, of course, when any threat would come upon them from any quarter, the first one to know would be, really, to get the information would be Nehemiah himself, because he's the center of command. So they would, with all haste and speed, see that he would get the information. And he had by him the man with the trumpet. And you can with a trumpet, give information. We even use sometimes what we call the old-fashioned loudspeaker that the coxswains used on boats, you know, to encourage them in rowing in a race. You had this funnel with an open mouth, and you'd shout through it, and it would amplify your voice and tell the, you know, the crew how what to do. Well, the same thing with the trumpet, it has that effect. And you can even convey messages with the trumpet, not necessarily words, but the type of sound and all as to where the warning is to watch out for. And when they would have a technique that when the danger would arise, that there would be indications by the others as they would look and stop what they're doing and look. There was some other method of showing where the danger was so that they knew how to react to the situation as it existed at that moment. So he was like in command and had this man with a trumpet, and you can be sure he was expert with the blowing of that trumpet, and would he had this tightly organized. Now before they had to have like half and half, you know, on the alert. But then when they saw later as time went on, then they could relax more and more people could be involved with the labor shift, giving relief, because they get very tired in it. So as the danger would arise, then accommodation would be made to prepare for attack. What verse are we on now, please? What? What?
19.
Oh, I'm in the wrong thing there. Oh, I let's see.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in the wrong chapter, I guess. Where?
419.
Oh, I see. All right. Let us read three verses.
And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, The work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place, therefore, ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye thither unto us. Our God shall fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared.
And the next, that was three verses, all right. And they would be separated far from one another, because the city was large as far as the wall is concerned. And also, hilly would be very exhausting. The terrain was not just one flat plateau. Any question or comment on the three verses? Evidently, either the trumpeter that was beside Nehemiah, or they had others with instruction that they would run to the place where the danger was most imminent, and the trumpet would be blown there, and they would then go by sound. That would be another aid as to where to prepare for a conflict. Another thing, to attack a city at night would be more difficult as far as an armed assault, because the inhabitants in the city, they wouldn't know where they're positioned. So if they rush through the wall, they could be sitting ducks to the defenders, so long as they were alert. And when the stars appeared, let's say the moon too, it would be more difficult for an offensive to take place, and it would favor those on the defensive at night within the confines of the city. Let's read two more.
Likewise, at the same time, said I unto the people, let every one with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us, and labor on the day. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that every one put them off of washing.
Yeah. So we can see. Let's say, you know, if you have clothes on for a month and with energy working, they wouldn't have much time for laundry. And this was a situation of life and death. And they would have to wash sometime because of the bugs and the leeches and whatever else would be on their. But that would be done in the daytime or in the starlight, depending on whatever. So they would have, it was discomforting. And those who are defending the city are not merely the inhabitants of Jerusalem, but the outlying residents of Jewry who returned to their villages. They would assist in the sense of relieving them on guard duty, so that the ones who worked all day would have a decent night's sleep to work the next day. And the ones who worked were the inhabitants of the city defending their homes. But to have the others come in and act, and they needed everybody they could to come into the city to help bring provender, food, and to relieve them in little daily tasks that they could not do otherwise.
Brother, what was wall itself like? Was it stone wall?
Yes, stone. Yes, large blocks. Large blocks.
With mortar or just...
Well, what they would do, first the rubble, when the city would be destroyed originally, they wouldn't split up every rock. They tumbled, they removed the masonry, they were bonded, let's say, with mortar, or put into place through gravity, cleverly. They would just push the wall down. And the stones in falling, some of them would break. But it would be some mess that's down below. So they would salvage from the rubble the stones and then use that as the main, because they didn't have time to do too much quarry. But some was done, because it tells in the account earlier that stones were brought in. Doesn't say it that way, but there's enough evidence. But they used mostly, it was the material of the previous wall that they used again.
And the cedars that they put
that
in?
They had to bring in, because that couldn't be used. It was burnt by fire. Remember, the gates were burned with fire.
For the gates?
Yeah. The gates were burned with fire. And also on the walls, and some types of wall, you have beams to strengthen the wall. We use in, like, concrete today, they put long steel rods or iron rods in the cement as a binder. Well, in the old walls, they used even beams, but not that you could see them, but inside the walls as binders, so that the stones, when they come down, that they would be less friable or loosable. Another chapter now, right? Mm-hmm. Chapter 5. 3 verses. Whose turn?
And there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren the Jews. For there were that said, We are sons and our daughters are many. Therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth.
All right. Now, this was a problem for them, because when you're building the wall, you're not building crops. You're not harvesting. You're not sowing. You're not... And every able-bodied person with strength was engaged with defensive weapons, swords, armor, and building. But that left the rest of the population of Jewry, the old, the young, the women, with the... They had to now do the support of them. And being that their own men were not out plowing or doing the things to get food, They started to sell that which they had to use for bartering purposes, to barter to get the food, to feed themselves, as well as to feed the menfolk who were engaged in building the wall. But now what had happened, they didn't do this with the Ammonites, the Ashdodites. They didn't, because they were enemies. So what had happened is, it's the people outside of Jerusalem that had, let's say, a house or tent or whatever they had, and land. They were the ones that were to support the people in the city. And what happened, the families of those who lived in the city, they would be particularly hard straits, because it was their menfolk defending their houses against the wall, and they were put in a poor situation that they would then depend on their fellow Jews for help. And the fellow Jews were we cannot just give you anything. You want whatever you want, wheat, rye, or so forth. They exacted usury on their brethren who were engaged in this work and made it hard for them so that they sold their children and daughters as servants to other Jews who provided them with provender. But Nehemiah had to solve. And we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, houses, that we might buy corn. Because you can't eat the land and the vines, nor the houses. You need food. Let's read, was it 4 and 5?
Yes. And there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax upon our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren. Our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved. But it is not in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards."
All right. They're living in their lands. But now that which was formerly theirs is mortgaged or is the property of others, and they're now their slaves instead of the masters of their own home. This is outside the city of Jerusalem. And the poorer folk. But there were some people who went back who were quite wealthy. So when they returned, the 42,000, some returned very wealthy. The monies that were used that was common property to the nation, that was used for other purposes. The Persian Empire, when it said to them, "You can go back," they expected the returned Jews to pay a tax on the properties when they returned. In other words, when Israel returned to their land, the land was not theirs. They were allowed to go back, but the land belonged to the Persian, theoretically, the Persian Empire. But that is in the final result. But the rich were the one of the Jews had took over the lease of the land. So the rich among the Jews owned the land of the poorer Jews. And the poorer Jews are now in between the upper and lower millstone, because they not only had to provide food for themselves and so forth, there was this tax that had to be paid on the land that they had. The land that was mortgaged to their fellow brethren, but in reality, they had to pay the tax to them. So they were in real straight. So this is Nehemiah's problem. We read 5, and now it's 6. Let's read 3 verses.
"And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said unto them, Ye exact usury, every one from his and of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them. And I said unto them, We after our ability have redeemed our brethren the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. And will ye even sell your brethren? Or shall they be sold unto us? Then they held their peace and found nothing to answer."
Now we see the difference between, as it were, Ezra combated this along moral lines by his own humiliation, remorse, tears, rending his garments. Nehemiah used a different strategy than Ezra. This is now along another line. Anger. This is like Moses being angry. He must have really
righteous
indignation. And really was burning with anger and using reason, and he also assembled others to be with him as a backup. So, and he convened this assembly and spoke real tough to them and told them, and when they'd say usury, why, that's against the law of Moses to start with. And then he himself was very wealthy, Nehemiah. This comes out as you finish the whole book. He, as the cupbearer of the king, but he used his wealth in many different ways. We have the rich today, and they give out some of them a lot of their money, but it's usually surplus, like endowments, things like that. Philanthropic, that's what I'm trying to say. Filio, brotherly love, philanthropic projects for mankind, the Red Rockefeller, and the different ones. Well, he was very, very wealthy, Nehemiah, but he made it a project. He and others who came back of the nobility that were in Persia, he got his others with himself to redeem those from bondage who were sold to those enemies outside. And now he's saying, we have given of our wealth, and he would have them back him up, what they gave to redeem the brethren in alien captivity, in the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, and so forth, those that are around. And here, in Israel, in Jewry, here's some that are captive and as working as men and women slaves to fellow Jews, and he says, what are you doing? Here we're redeeming them, and you're doing to your own people. But he must have been really furious, and that worked. It, the message got over, and so you have to have the type of individual to use strategy and shame and indignation, and put them in their place. And he, on another occasion, tells again that he just took his wealth and just distributed it as best he could so he could shame them. He's not telling them to sell everything they have. You know what? So they got the message. They held their peace and found nothing to answer. Let us read three verses. Next.
Also I said, it is not good that ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also the hundredth part of the money, and of the corn, the wine, and the oil that ye exact of them.
Right. Now, notice he's saying, now, you today, right now, he's not saying, go back and, now, from this moment on, he's saying another thing. When Ezra went back, and the others of the captivity, those that were in leadership positions, got a stipend from the Persian government when Ezra went back and all. Because it mentions the monies and all that they received. It even gives you the how many thousand talents or whatever it was of this and that. Not just merely of the rich of the Jewry who did not leave Babylon, but even the government of Persia furnished, as it were, a sort of a dowry for them to return, and a stipend. It was, I think, 40 shekels or something like that, which was quite a bit of money. There was an annual salary. And so Nehemiah is saying, I and others of my command who are entitled to this, that these others got of the returned Jews. This is 82 years after Cyrus' decree. 82 years after Cyrus. They were supported. The governors of Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, and the others, they had a salary. But Nehemiah says, I have no salary. It's I'm living off my own wealth, and not even depending on support from you, which the government of Persia has entitled me to. That I, as governor of Jerusalem, am entitled to exact taxes of you, not just merely Persia get taxes. You owe me money, and which I'm not taking. This reminds you of Moses? I haven't taken a donkey or shoelace of anybody. You know, Moses said when he led Israel that with all the authority at his hand that could enrich him, he says, what man among you that I owe a penny to or exacted anything from you? Moses said this to Israel, as it were. I'm saying it in a different way. So Nehemiah is using the same tactic. I have supported myself in this. And you, he is really shaming it to them, and he's making them commit themselves, and not merely to give back the land, but even to give a little back of the usury, of the interest. What was it, 100 part or something? Which is 1%? 1%. They were to return what they exacted of the others, plus 1% interest, because they had prospered in that time. That was a low tax, but they... It would take... So you'd be interested to see a man like this. And wouldn't this be interesting? What do you want the movies for in this? Truth is not only stranger than fiction, it's more interesting than fiction, because truth is truth, and history is history. And so you can see when these things are shown in the future how helpful, how constructive and character-building that such documentaries would be upon those beholding them, instead of the trash that we see today, which is pulling down the whole populace down to the gutter and down the drain. Let us read 2 more verses.
Then said they, we will restore them and will require nothing of them, so will we do as you say it. Then I called the priest and took an oath of them, that they should do according to this promise. Also I shook my lap and said, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise, even thus be he shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, Amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did according to this promise.
How wonderful this was, because he not only relied on the power of shame on them, but made them take an oath to God, to before a priest. So this day they would sign an oath. Now when they go back home, like they said in the law, all these things will we do at the hearing of the law. But then when they left, they began to diverge gradually down through the centuries. But he sees that emotionalism is not enough to be stirred up, by talk. It's sometimes you hear a good talk and you're very, very stirred up and so forth. But a month later, a week later, the power that has wore off. But when you have a contract, when you've made an oath to God, and rather before the priest, I tell you, this is marvelous. He was the man that God chose. He filled him with lessons, information that is reflected on how he handled this particular situation.
it should be like our consecration vow. That's to God.
Yes.
And then, despite the emotionalism in the beginning, now this is a lifelong vow.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point. That with regard to the Christian, you have a Billy Graham crusade, and thousands or hundreds go up to the thing and give their hearts to Jesus. But it's the solemnity of the vow that is with a really binding influence on the Christian. So those that sincerely do that, they know that's no light thing to have made a vow to the Lord along that line. So we are committed for life, as it were, because of that vow. And
he wasn't taking their word, though. I mean, they said they'd do it, and then he goes,
yeah,
the priest,
that's what I'm saying.
God.
See, that's emotionalism. But this other, that's stark reality. You know, you commit. And so anybody who now broke it, they were not going against Nehemiah. They're going to go against the oath that they made. Whatever. And then shaking. Demonstrated this with the shaking of his lap. Just like you get a bug on you, and you have an apron, you want to get rid of it, you know. You shake it off, and he says, those of you that don't fulfill this, that's done, this, let may God do this to you. So they, now when they would go back, they would remember. That was some talk he gave. You can be sure that when we remember the Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, how wonderful that Lincolnsburg Gettysburg Address. It was short and right to the point, and those that would be there and hear it delivered and all, they would remember that. They would remember that for a while. Well, here Nehemiah is. He not only spoke, he acted, and he made them sign on the dotted line that, and all these things we will do. And it said the people did. That doesn't mention the exceptions. If there are any exceptions, that would be minor. It's he got the work done.
This is like the Jubilee, isn't it, where they
yeah.
have to do that and give back to the...
Yeah, well, that was a contractual arrangement, yes.
14 and 15.
All right. 14, 15. Next, please.
Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, in the 20th year, even unto the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. But the former governors that had been before me were chargeable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine, 40 shekels of silver, yea, even their servants bear rule over the people. But so did not I, because of the fear of God.
All right. That is self-explanatory.
He doesn't mean Zerubbabel as a former governor, did this.
Yes, yes.
Zerubbabel?
Yeah, yeah. There's nothing absolutely wrong, especially if you haven't got the means. There was Zerubbabel. There were a number. But the governor was to exact taxes.
It says heavy burdens, though. That's as if it's derogatory, not just taxes, but heavy.
Oh, yeah. Well, that. Mm-hmm. But for support, mm-hmm. Now, like take the Apostle Paul, he went as a tent maker. But he says that there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And he inferred there were examples in Scripture, but he doesn't say it quite that way, but that there's absolutely nothing wrong. But rather than used as a means of later, what do you call it, derogatory statements and things being made, he stated his case. We know the Philippians helped Paul as well as others, but particularly the church of Philippi. Let's read two more verses.
Yea, also I continued in work of this wall. Neither bought we any land, and all my servants were gathered thither unto the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 of the Jews and rulers, besides those that came unto us from among the heathen that are about us.
Right. Next two verses.
Now that which was prepared for me daily was one ox and six choice sheep. Also fowls were prepared for me, and once in 10 days store of all sorts of wine. Yet for all this required not I the bread of the governor, because the bondage was heavy upon this people. Think upon me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done with this people.
All right. Now, he mentions that his own entourage was over 150 people, because he mentions 150 of the of some of the elite of Jewry, some of the princes, but who were in Persia, who were associated with him when he was cupbearer, that when those Jews came back with him, well, he was supporting them daily with food, provender, you know, and did not exact of the people a reasonable income that should have come to him. So he deleted his own capital. And now he goes back. 12 years was the time that he had promised Artaxerxes. He went on leave of absence for 12 years. Now he's going to return. He has to return because the time is expired. So we'll conclude here, unless somebody wants to make a comment.